I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Howdy there, my friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. I'm Cam Hale, driving this crazy bus, and right here beside me, this psycho that we've been laughing and cutting up this whole time preparing for this, mi amigo, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm excited to be here. It is a hot day. It's a holiday here in the United States. It's our Independence Day coming up, and if you're listening to this and you're an American, happy 4th of July to you. But we know we have a lot of listeners in other places of the world, so for you, it's just a normal weekend. But either way, me and Cam, we're going to do this little recording, then we're going to go outside, we're going to throw some stuff on the grill, we're going to go splash around in the pool.
And drink.
Maybe play a little wiffle ball or something. Yeah. I know we're playing dominoes, me and the guys, we always play dominoes. A Texas game, it's called Texas 42. Not traditional dominoes, but it's played with dominoes, and it's a very fun game. And also, we'll probably be playing... horseshoes or something like, typical stuff, parties,
yeah.
And waiting for the fireworks display. But what's been going on in your world, Cam? I know you said you've been recently working on building some actual home furniture.
Well, what I was doing is I wanted a bigger computer desk for my office. And I had a decent one, but I wanted a bigger one. I wanted to get it all up in front of me and it's got the... Anyway, I just didn't like the one I had. So I was like, all right, I'll just build one. So basically all weekend, I've been... Got all my tools out and all of my saws and jigs and all that stuff out. And I built a computer desk. So I was like, all right, let's go for it.
Well, that's good, man. It's good to get out there. I think one thing that's funny is a lot of women, they just don't understand the equipment that it takes to make stuff. My wife finds pictures like on Pinterest. Be like, hey, can you make this for me? I'm like, no. Well, why not? Well, you have to have about $3,000 worth of tools to even produce that. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
They just don't think, you don't just nail something together. And you got a couple saws out there,
but
you got to have a different one for that.
Yeah. You got to have.
They don't understand,
tools,
right?
Yeah. It was fun, dude. I enjoy it. Except for the fact, of course, it's 100 degrees.
Yeah.
It's going to be 100, at least here in Weatherford, for the next 2 weeks. I've already looked. Everything's going to hit. It's been hot, but... It's supposed to.
It's supposed to be, right? And I will say this, for it already being July, my yard has never looked as green as it is right now.
I know, right?
Normally it's burnt brown by this time in Texas. So I don't know, it's a combination of the cooler weather in conjunction with all the rain that we got. But my yard looks awesome.
It's great.
My neighbor spends hundreds of dollars on fertilizer and stuff.
How silly is that?
I don't spend a dime. My yard looks better than his.
I think it's silly. You know why? Because you're full of crap. It just runs out of the yard out there. Keeps everything green. Me and Kyle have been talking about beers. You can have some cans of beers, and all that stuff. And it's fun to drink, sit down with your buddies and all that stuff. And I found something cool that I think y'all are going to like. I know Kyle's going to enjoy this. This comes from arsteca.com. And it says this. 5,000-year-old pay stub shows that ancient workers were paid in beer.
Really?
That's right. Yes. In ancient Mesopotamian city of Urk, it says residents enjoyed many benefits of modern life. The city, located in modern-day Iraq, was home to massive ziggurats that would rival any of today's modern skyscrapers for sheer monumentality. It says, it goes on, though, that says that the people there exchanged goods for money and even played board games, and they used clay tablets to send each other letters. And they use it, what we've talked about on the show before, but it's cuneiform writing that's on there.
Yeah.
Well, they found this tablet, and written on this tablet, now, and they actually have a picture of it. It's actually in the museum there in the British Museum. But it's a labor's pay stub, and that they were paid in beer. That's right. Now, Allison George, which is a writer for The New Scientist, says that we can see a human head eating from a bowl, meaning ration, and a conical vessel, meaning beer. Now, scattered around are scratches, recording the amount of beer for a particular worker. So they have this listed out there. Now, he goes on to talk about how much it was, but it says that they believe that people received beer for their work, roughly 4 to 5 liters per day for people building the pyramids.
That's awesome. Well, you got to think about it, too. It's not like today where there's so many drinks. Basically, you had water, you had wine, or you had some kind of beer or mead, and maybe tea.
Yeah.
Outside of that, you didn't have anything to drink. And, you know, it sounds a little bit ridiculous, but I totally believe that. When I was in college, I pretty much just worked for beer. I mean, I worked for money, but then I spent almost all that money on beer. So,
well, you think
basically, I was working for beer.
Yeah. But it was also because that was a safe thing to drink.
Yeah. Well, you're right.
Because you have to boil it. So that's the difference. That's why wine, you know, wine's for, but it's also, it's a safe thing to drink.
And the alcohol,
water,
too.
Exactly.
Like, you know,
so that
sends off bacteria and stuff that can be in water. You're 100% right.
Well, and it was also a way to get nutrition. So there was a lot of the way this stuff was paid. They go in and they talk a bunch of stuff. They talk that people were paid roughly, even in wine, an annual salary of 252 gallons a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a really interesting thing. So you can check into it. But it is funny, folks. So when you're out buying your beer or your wine, just think about it. I mean, this isn't a new thing. If you spent some of your hard-earned money that you sold bits and pieces of hours of your life away for, it's been going on for, we know, at least 5,000 years, and it will continue to go on for as long as the sun's overhead.
Let's move on to some crazy UFO sighting. Recently, a guy called into Ground Zero Radio and told of an unusual UFO sighting that he had back in the 1980s up in New Hampshire. Now, check this out. He says, I want to tell you about what I saw in New Hampshire back during the Reagan years. It was quite a ways back. As far as the exact time, I really don't know. But anyways, I came home with my wife. My son was asleep in the back seat. He was a little boy back then. And we lived right on the power lines. I get home and she says, I gotta take Max in. And I look down the power lines and I see what looks like two headlights. It looked like a car's headlights, and there's a road up there called Chemung Road in Meredith, New Hampshire. And the headlights would normally be going down, you know, across the power lines instead of pointing towards me, I said. Man, I looked at it for a few seconds. I said, man, that's weird. There's a car facing this way. That's odd. So she takes the kid in, and I see those headlights coming towards me, which, again, like I say, was very bizarre, down the power line. So I went in to get her and said, come out here. You got to see this. Look at those headlights. We both watched them come down the power line. And I work in construction, so I know what distances are. And I want to say that this, and I also drag race, so I know what an eighth of a mile is. And I think it looked like that. Now, originally the lights were at the eighth mile mark, so I had time to go in and get her and still watch these lights come very slowly down the power line. I'm going to say this was 150 feet in the air. It was right over our head, silent, and it had green and red on the ends of it, like a plane would have. Now, that was a common thing for a plane, but it had more of a triangular shape. It was somewhat foggy. We couldn't make it out exactly. It went by us and was coming up towards us. It had no sound whatsoever. It was very much hovering, and it went by us, and it still drops down after that. It kind of made it sound like a whistling sound. And when it got to the next knoll where it went up, it made the whistling sound again. So it obviously had some kind of turbine. I'm familiar with jet cars and stuff. I know what a turbine is, but it was very much a slow turning thing. The way it changed speed was not anything conventional, but it had no sound when it was coming towards us. But after it left, we heard the whistling part. And my wife said, I don't know if it was taking power from the power lines, which was giving it the energy to hover above, like powering up, but it was definitely following the power line. Now, that's an interesting sighting. And the reason I bring that up, because we've talked, when I saw this, and we've talked before on the show, what popped out at me is this is numerous times now, several times, where I've read these stories of UFOs near power lines and like power stations, like they're recharging or they're interested in what we're doing with these towers and lines and these power, or also like nuclear sites. It just reminds me, we were just in Glen Rose the other day with the Bruds yesterday. And we went to the river there, and we were swimming in the river and stuff. And I saw those nuclear power plant. I'm like, man, I've always wanted to go in there and take a tour. But it seems like whatever these UFOs are, and it truly is UFO, doesn't mean it's alien, unidentified flying object, a literal term. But whatever these things are, they're often seen around power lines and power grids and stuff. And I think that's bizarre, right?
It's very strange. Like we've discussed, and I mean, you can't, it always makes me laugh because I'm like, well, if you've had all this ability to get to our planet, why you got to use our energy? You obviously don't need it, but people talk about they seem like it's recharging. So then it starts making you wonder, well, then is it like the breakaway society stuff? You know, I mean, it's just one of those questions. It makes it really, really odd that you see them there. But it does seem like there's a lot seen around power lines and power substations and things.
Yeah, I mean, I've also often wondered, you know, they talk about living underneath power lines can give you cancer and stuff. Could there be some kind of field created near power lines and it makes you hallucinate?
There has to be something. Yeah, there's something. It's just, there's too much, it seems to me, that there's too many people and too much stuff has been done around, in and around power lines where they know something's not right with that.
Right. Well, when I look at a house at my job and it's near those power lines, I'm talking really close, I'm always like, man, why would somebody live here?
Yeah.
Because you can hear it.
Humming. Yeah.
So there's got to be something.
Something's up.
Right? It can't be healthy.
It can't be. No, something's up. Kyle, what do you think about clowns? Do you have a problem with them?
I find them annoying, especially mimes. I find them annoying, like when they won't leave you alone, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, because I know people that really are disturbed by clowns.
My wife is one of those people. She's very scared of clowns. And my little brother, he's very, very terrified. I remember when we were kids, you know, of course, the famous Pennywise, you know, the Stephen King movie was on, and he saw that as a child, and I think that transformed his life ever since. He was deathly afraid of clowns.
He just hated them. Well, I got something you're going to like here. My sister-in-law sent this to me because she got a kick out of it. I don't have a problem with them at all. I think it's funny. In fact, like I told you that I want to go as Captain Spaulding for Halloween one year with my big beard and all that just because it's kind of creepy. But apparently there's a place, and I know I'm not going to get this right. It's in Nevada. I want to say it looks like here it's Tonopah, Nevada. But if you go to, there's a website you can go to, but there is a clown motel where the entire motel is clowns, and it's in Tonopah, Nevada. And it sits next door to an old miner's graveyard.
So this is a hotel designed for clowns to stay at?
No. The whole thing is like a giant clown museum. Everything is creepy clown stuff. And it says here, and this is what it says on its website. It talks about it. It says it claims to cater mostly to bikers, truckers, and cross-country drivers. Well, that makes me think of Dust Till Dawn whenever you think about that, right?
Makes me think of like the Griswolds going to Wally World. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And well, they talk about it's a real rough, you know, kind of remote part of this area out there. But you need, if you want to really, you know, test yourself, I guess, and you have a problem with them, to stay there. But it's called Clown Motel. And it is eat up with it. There's even a video you can go to on YouTube called Nevada's Clown Motel is the Scariest Motel in America. You can go on YouTube, pull that up, and watch it. But it's creepy. But it just says clowns upon clowns upon clowns. And there's pictures on here of all these. It's collections of dolls and masks and trinkets and life-size clowns. I can't tell if people are dressing up as clowns in this that work here or whatnot. But, I mean, some of them look real. Some of them look evil. It is definitely a very unnerving little situation that you need to find yourself at in Nevada. So that's something, folks. If you want to have some really fun with your friends that have an issue with clowns, run them out there to that little place. Take a little road trip and go check that out.
Yeah, that sounds terrifying for those people that are scared of those things. Moving on, let's move into a little bit of archaeology. Recently, some researchers in Bolivia found two skeletons, Cam, with abnormally elongated skulls. Now, they say that Finnish, these guys are from Finland, archaeologists working near the village of Patapatani in Bolivia, recently found the remains of at least six individuals buried under an Amira funerary tower, which was built thousands of years ago for people of royal status in the ancestral culture. Now, interestingly, two of the skeletons were of particular interest. Now, one of these skeletons belonged to a woman, and the other one was her baby, they believe. Nothing out of the ordinary, other than the fact that they had a freakishly large, elongated skull that were not the result of cranial deformation.
Mm.
So, you know, we've told you, everybody knows if you put ropes and stuff in your head, you can actually shape your head like that. But they proved that it wasn't that. One researcher that began looking into this strange phenomenon was a guy named Brian Forrester, and he's best known for his extensive research and, of course, the infamous Paracas skulls. You've seen those mm-hmm. from Peru with the elongated skull. And he took a trip to Parapatani Museum, where researchers transferred the skeletons that were on Earth. In his journey, Brian Forrester was accompanied by an American radiologist, an expert in human anatomy, and a Bolivian researcher and author named Antonio Portugal. Now, according to these experts, based on the shape of the pelvis, the skeleton we see in the images belongs to a young woman who died pre-adolescence. The young girl had an elongated head that exceeds the proportions of artificial cranial deformation, raising the question that what could have caused such atypical features. Now, in addition to the skeleton of the young girl, they also found a fetus, and it also had an elongated skull. They think that this was about 9 months old, so perhaps it died and the mother died during child labor or something like that. But what's crazy is the fact that they know that this thing was born with an elongated skull. It wasn't created, okay? So here's a perfect specimen. This baby was only 9 months old, so they didn't even have time to do any deformation.
It was born like that.
It was born like that. And what they're saying is this possibly could be what they're looking at, which they're very excited about, a subspecies of ancient humans that died out thousands of years ago. Now, how cool is that? That we just might have discovered a new subspecies?
That's awesome.
And maybe there were these people with elongated skulls, and some of that DNA was why you hear of, like, King Tutankhamun, mm-hmm. stuff like that. They said that they had weird-looking skulls. Now, it was, you know, theorized that it was from incest.
Yes.
But maybe maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was a leftover remnants of this subspecies of humans that were carried over. Also, you see a lot of the cave paintings and carvings and stuff where they're saying, well, obviously, these people are, you know, painting or carving what was extraterrestrials. You know, like Zachariah Sitchin theorizes this stuff. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe these people were just painting and carving this subspecies of humans. But pretty interesting. I really like these stories, especially when it comes to archaeology. But we're about to take a break, folks. And when we get back from the break, we're going to be talking about a real-life monster, a guy named Albert Fish. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
L-E-T-E-N-E-C. Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
One of the most terrifying things are monsters. You begin to fear them at a very young age. Whether you read about them, or accidentally saw one on a scary movie, or a friend or older sibling told you about them, at some point, everyone somehow becomes aware of them. Perhaps they are in your closet, maybe under your bed. Many of you have slept with a nightlight on, or begged your parents to let you sleep with your door cracked just a little bit, so a little light pierced your dark room. Your parents, of course, would tell you that there are no such things as monsters. You yourself might have told your own children this. I hate to be the one to tell you, and what you may not know, and what your parents might not have known, is that monsters are real. Sure, they may not look like the beasts portrayed on film, but they are nevertheless real. One of the most diabolical monsters in American history was a man named Albert Fish. He looked like every child's favorite grandfather. But behind the quiet facade of his silver hair and mustache lurked a hideous monster who preyed on the young and the innocent with his horrific instruments of hell. A meat cleaver, a butcher knife, and a bone saw. He was a self-admitted molester of more than 400 children during a span of 20 years, and in the words of one of the shocked psychiatrists who examined him, he lived a life of unparalleled perversity. Albert Fish remains one of the oldest men ever executed in the electric chair, but it was a death that came far too late for many of his victims. After his capture, Fish would blame the conditions of his childhood for his crimes. Although he was related to an ancestor who fought in the American Revolution, Fish was abandoned at an early age and placed in an orphanage, where he saw and experienced his first brutal acts of sadism. He had been born in 1870 in the Washington, D.C. area, and later married and raised six children. He had a minor public education and mostly worked as a handyman and a painter. It's likely that his psychosis actually manifested much earlier, but according to the testimony of one of his children, his weird and unpredictable behavior did not begin to surface until January 1917. It was at this time that his wife ran away with John Straub, a slow-witted handyman who boarded with the Fish family. Fish returned from work one day to find the house deserted and stripped of all of its furniture. Miss Fish was apparently a bit odd herself. She once returned to her husband with Straub at her side and asked if they could move in with the family. Fish said that she could, but that her lover could not, and she agreed and sent Straub away. Days later, Fish discovered that his wife had actually secreted Straub in the attic, and he lurked there while she smuggled food up to him. Again, Fish told her that she could stay, but that Straub had to leave. They both departed this time, and the family never saw Miss Fish again. Soon after, Fish began to behave very strangely. He took his family up to their summer home, Wisteria Cottage in Westchester County, New York, for outings, and they would watch terrified as he climbed a nearby hill and would shake his fist at the sky and repeatedly scream, "I am Christ!" Pain seemed to delight him, whether inflicting it on himself or others. He took strange pleasure in being whipped and paddled. He even encouraged his own children and neighborhood children to paddle his buttocks until it bled, often using a paddle that had studded inch-and-a-half-long nails in it. He also inserted a large number of needles into his body, mostly in the genital region, and he burned himself constantly with hot irons and hot pokers. He even answered classified ads placed with widows seeking husbands. His letters, 46 of them that were recovered, were so obscene and vile that the prosecution refused to make them public. Basically, Fish told the lovelorn ladies that he was not as interested in the marriage as he was in their willingness to paddle him. None of the women accepted his offers. As time went on, he became more bizarre. On nights when the moon was full, his children later testified that Fish would consume huge quantities of raw meat, and over the years, he collected a great amount of published material on cannibalism, and he carried out the most gruesome articles with him on his person at all times. Before he ever turned to murder, Fish was examined several times by psychiatrists at Bellevue, but he was always released and judged disturbed but sane. When and where Fish became a murderer isn't really known. He confessed to six killings and referred vaguely to dozens more. And although the victims, dates, and places were lost to his hazy memory, he did confess to murdering a man in Willington, Delaware, also mutilating and torturing to death a mentally challenged boy in New York in 1910. Later, he confessed to killing another boy in Washington in 1919, molesting and killing 4-year-old William Gaffney in 1929, and strangling to death 5-year-old Francis McDonald on Long Island in 1934. The most sensational murder carried out by Fish was the abduction and horrific slaughter of Grace Budd in 1928. Her abduction led to a manhunt that lasted for 6 years. The local police had all but given up on ever solving her mysterious disappearance until a slender clue gleaned from an anonymous letter sent to the girl's parents that led detectives right to Albert Fish. Fish introduced himself to the Buds in a way that never raised suspicions with the hardworking family. Albert Budd, Grace's father, earned a modest living as a doorman, but it never seemed to be enough to adequately take care of the entire family, which consisted of his wife, Delia, 18-year-old Edward, Albert Jr., Grace, and the youngest child, 5-year-old Beatrice. To help his father make ends meet, Edward advertised in the May 27, 1928 issue of the New York World Telegram for a job. His ad read, "Young man, 18, wishes position in the country," followed by his name and his address. That same afternoon, a nicely dressed Albert Fish answered the ad and showed up at the Budd home in the Chelsea district of Manhattan. He introduced himself as Mr. Frank Howard, a farmer from Long Island who was willing to pay $15 per week to a willing young worker. Now, the family could scarcely believe Edward's luck and good fortune and quickly invited Mr. Howard into their house. And after hearing Fish's description of the farm, Edward readily accepted the position. Mr. Howard promised to return the next week and take not only Edward out to the farm, but his friend Willie as well. Howard stressed that he had enough work for both of the young men. Well, Fish didn't return as promised on June 2nd or the following Saturday, but he did send an apologetic telegram and arrived on Monday instead. Impressed by his manners, the Buds greeted him in warmly and invited him in to stay for lunch. Fish behaved just like a visiting grandfather and passed out treats and dollar bills to the children. He presented two of the bills to Eddie and Willie, and while he had a prior engagement, he promised to return that evening to pick them up and take them out to his farm. However, he had a special treat for the oldest daughter, Grace. He told her trusting parents if they were agreeable to the idea, he wanted to take her to a children's birthday party at the home of his married sister at 137th Street and Columbus Avenue. The Buds readily agreed, and Grace left with Fish, holding on to his hand, still wearing the pure white dress that she had worn to church that morning. The two of them walked down the street together. The Buds waved goodbye to their little girl and never saw her alive again. When Grace did not return home that night with Mr. Howard, the Buds were concerned, but not overly worried. They assumed that the party had lasted late and that she had likely spent the night with Mr. Howard's sister. They tried hard to convince themselves of this, even into the following morning, when there was still no sign of Grace. Finally, Albert Budd decided to go to the address himself and inquire after his daughter. However, he soon found that the address where Howard's sister supposedly lived did not even exist. Columbus only went as far as 109th Street. This made his next stop the closest police station available, where he was referred to the Missing Persons Bureau and eventually taken to a veteran detective named William King. The detectives were suspicious of the situation right from the start. It didn't take them long to find that there was no Frank Howard with a farm out on Long Island. This also meant that there was no real clue to the abductor's true identity. The old man had covered his tracks well, going as far as to retrieve the telegram that he had sent to the Buds. He claimed that he was going to complain to Western Union because it had been addressed incorrectly. Regardless, King and other members of the Bureau started a long and arduous search for the Western Union copy of the telegram. It was the only link that he had with Grace's kidnapper, and three postal clerks spent more than 15 hours sifting through tens of thousands of duplicates with King before they found the one that Howard had sent. The only clue it provided was that it had been sent from an office in East Harlem. The idea of searching every home in that part of the city was first considered, but then abandoned as a physical impossibility. King then focused on another slim link, a small pail of cheese and a carton of strawberries that Howard had purchased for Miss Budd. He told her that they were fresh from his farm. The investigators scoured the East Harlem area until they found a delicatessen where Howard had bought the cheese, and they also found a street peddler who had sold him the strawberries. The peddler described the man in detail, but could not recall anything else about him. At this point, the trail ran cold. Grace Budd's disappearance started a widespread search through New York City that fall, particularly when the detective and the family went to the media with the story. Grace's photo appeared on the front page of newspapers and garnered hundreds of tips, leads, and investigation advice from an angry and panicked public. Thousands of circulars were printed and sent out to police departments throughout the United States and Canada, but with no results. The Budds grew more and more despondent as lead after lead went nowhere. A couple of months after Grace vanished, even the most dedicated investigators, with the exception of William King, had given up on the case as hopeless. King was already a legend in New York law enforcement circles, and he was the only investigator who never gave up hope. Not a day went by when he did not at least think of Grace one time and her grieving parents, and when he did not put at least some time on the case, following up on long shots and making calls. He never let a lead cross his desk that he himself didn't look into. At one point, King was sure that he was on to his man when he received a file on a gray-haired con man and forager named Albert Corthell, who was on the run for trying to abduct a little girl from an adoption agency. King tracked Corthell for months, chasing him from city to city across the country, and he finally caught up with him and was crushed when he found out that Corthell had been in prison in Seattle when Grace was taken. Corthell turned out to be one of two strong leads that King pursued over six long years. Another suspect, Charles Edward Pope, was also arrested and actually charged in Grace's kidnapping. However, Miss Budd, the principal witness in the case, admitted in court that she had picked out the wrong man. It turned out that Pope had been blamed for the kidnapping by his vindictive ex-wife, and he was subsequently released. Around the same time that Corthell and Pope were being exhaustively investigated by the police, another gray-haired old man was arrested in New York and was charged with sending obscene materials, mostly letters, through the mail. The letters were sent with fish, pretending to be a well-known Hollywood movie producer, and then he offered large sums of money to women who might engage in sadomasochistic orgies with him. After his arrest, he was committed to the psychiatric ward at Bellevue for a 10-day observation. And while there, the letter writer claimed that although his friends knew him as Albert, his real name was Hamilton Fish, and he was a relative of the famous New York family of the same name. He would tell the same story again and again when arrested for Grace Budd's murder 4 years later. Fish remained in Bellevue for nearly 30 days in the winter of 1930. He was polite and cooperative, and the doctors judged him to be sane. And although he had a few sexual problems, they attributed them to dementia caused by his advancing age. He was thought harmless and was released from the hospital into the custody of his daughter, Anna. Meanwhile, years were passing in the Grace Budd case, and despite Detective King's ongoing efforts, it appeared that her vanishing would never be solved. Then, on November 11, 1934, 6 years after she had been kidnapped, Miss Budd received an unsigned and anonymous letter in the mail. The letter claimed to be from a friend of someone called Captain John Davis. Now, according to this letter writer, Captain Davis was a seafaring man who, on one of his trips to China, developed a taste for human flesh, namely, the flesh of children. The letter went on to describe in graphic terms how Captain Davis, after returning to New York, had kidnapped and murdered two young boys and cooked their flesh and had eaten it. What you're about to hear is the actual letter. My dear Miss Budd, in 1894, a friend of mine shipped as a deckhand on the steamer Tacoma, a Captain John Davis. They sailed from San Francisco for Hong Kong, China, and on arriving there, He and two others went ashore and got drunk. When they returned, the boat was gone. At that time, there was a famine in China. Meat of any kind was from $1 to $3 a pound. So great was the suffering among the poor that all children under 12 were sold to the butchers to be cut up and sold for food in order to keep the others from starving. A boy or girl under 14 was not safe in the street. You could go to any shop and ask for a steak or chops or stew meat, and part of the naked body of a boy or girl would be brought out, just what you wanted cut from it. A boy or girl's behind, which is the sweetest part of the body, and sold as veal cutlet, brought the highest price. Now John said that he had stayed there so long he acquired a taste for human flesh, and on his return to New York, he stole two boys, 1 7 and 1 11. He took them to his home, stripped them naked, tied them in a closet, then burned everything they had on. Several times a day and night, he spanked them and tortured them to make their meat good and tender. First, he killed the 11-year-old boy because he had the larger rump and, of course, the most meat on it. Every part of his body was cooked and eaten except the head, bones, and guts. He was roasted in the oven. He was boiled, broiled, fried, and stewed. And the little boy was next, and he went the same way. At that time, I was living at 409 East 100th Street. He told me so often how good human flesh was, I made up my mind to taste it. On Sunday, June 3rd, 1928, I called on you at 406 West 15th Street. I brought you a pot cheese and strawberries. We had lunch, and Grace sat in my lap and kissed me. I made up my mind right there to eat her. On the pretense of taking her to a party, you said yes, she could go, and I took her to an empty house in Westchester I had already picked out. When we got there, I told her to remain outside. She picked wildflowers. I went upstairs, stripped all my clothes off. I knew if I did not, I would get her blood on them. When all was ready, I went to the window and called down to her. Then, I hid in a closet until she was in the room. When she saw me all naked, she began to cry and tried to run downstairs. I grabbed her, and she said she would tell her mama. First, I stripped her naked. How she did kick and bite and scratch. I choked her to death, then cut her into small pieces so I could take the meat to my rooms, cook, and eat it. How sweet and tender her little hindquarters were roasted in the oven. It took me 9 days to eat her entire body. I did not have intercourse with her, though I could have if I wished. I assure you, she died a virgin. Now, after this horrific letter, investigators went into action, pulling out all the stops to find the monster who had written it. The investigation was again led by Detective King, who had deferred his retirement 2 years earlier so he could continue to work on the Grace Budd case. King immediately found Mr. Howard's original Western Union telegram, and there was no doubt about it. The handwriting was the same. Howard and the letter writer were one and the same person. King used a microscope on the letter and discovered an almost indiscernible design on the flap of the envelope. It turned out to be the letters NYPCBA. And a quick search through the Manhattan telephone directory revealed the letters to stand for the New York Private Chauffeurs Benevolent Association, which headquartered at 627 Lexington Avenue. The association gladly opened its files to Detective King, and he spent hours checking the backgrounds and handwriting of their 400 employees. Sadly, though, he did not come up with a match. Undaunted, he called all the employees together and questioned them rigorously. He also added an appeal for any information the drivers might have that could help him with the case. He offered immunity for theft of the letter-writing materials and envelopes. All he wanted was to catch the sadistic child killer. After his appeals to the drivers, King retreated to a private office in the association's headquarters and hoped that his assurances would pay off. A few minutes later, a nondescript man in a chauffeur's uniform named Lee Sikowski knocked on the door. He told Detective King that he had a habit of taking the association's stationery home with him and using it. In fact, Sikowski explained that he had left some of the unused notepaper and envelopes in a room that he had once occupied at 622 Lexington. Detectives raced to the rooming house, but there was nothing there. King then urged Sikowski to think of anywhere else the stationery could have been left. Sikowski then remembered that he had also spent some time in a cheap boarding house at 200 East 52nd Street. He might have left some of it there. This address turned out to be a flop house, but it was here that investigators struck gold. The landlady, Miss Frieda Schneider, stated that Sikowski's old room was rented and occupied by a man who fit Frank Howard's description. She said that his name was actually Albert Fish. They then carefully checked the signature in the room register, and he was convinced that the handwriting was one and the same as the person who wrote the letter. However, Fish had recently checked out of the place, but he was in the habit of receiving a monthly check from one of his sons. It was always sent to the 200 East 52nd Street address. King was prepared to invest a few more weeks in the hunt for the killer, and so he took a room at the flop house at the top of the stairs. This gave him a view of the entrance and the upstairs and downstairs hallways. He waited for 3 days, and on December 13, 1934, King received an urgent call from the flop house. He had left to return to the station and file some paperwork when the landlady called. Fish was back. When he returned to the house, Miss Schneider met him at the door. Fish had come back a half hour earlier, and to stall him until the detective could get there, she had given him a cup of tea and invited him to sit down. Trying to remain calm, King drew his revolver and walked into the room where Fish waited. What he found was a harmless-looking, white-haired old man with a scraggly mustache and watery blue eyes. He was sipping a cup of tea. Detective King identified himself, and Fish made no effort to conceal his own identity. Then, the detective asked Fish to accompany him to the police headquarters for questioning. King was then shocked and stunned when the seemingly harmless old man reached into his pocket and lunged at King with a vicious straight razor in his hand. Fish was no match for the solidly built officer, though, and King grabbed him by the wrist and twisted it until the razor dropped to the floor. He quickly handcuffed the old man, searched his pockets, and to his horror, he found that Fish's pockets were crammed with assorted sharp knives and razors. At the police station, Fish became more resigned to his arrest and confessed to succumbing to his bloodthirst in the summer of 1928. His original victim, he explained, had intended to be Edward Budd, who had placed the classified ad. However, when he got to the Budd house and saw the size of the stocky teenager, he changed his mind and set his sights on the more vulnerable Grace. He freely confessed to kidnapping the girl and taking her to Wisteria Cottage in a place called Worthington Woods in Westchester County. He had bought a round-trip train ticket to Worthington Woods for himself and a one-way ticket for Grace. And he also remembered that when they were changing trains, he had left a bundle behind on the seat. Grace, trying to be helpful, ran back and retrieved it for him. Inside the bundle were Fish's grisly tools of death, a cleaver, a saw, and a butcher's knife. And Grace happily handed them over, never knowing that they would be used to hack and dismember her body just a short time later. After arriving at Wisteria Cottage, Fish systematically strangled the girl, beheaded her, and dismembered her body, dissecting her torso at the waist, and then he cut her up and ate her over a 9-day period. Investigators later reported that Fish grinned as he described draining her blood and drinking it. The horrified detectives then made their own trip to Wisteria Cottage and recovered the skeletal remains of Grace Budd, buried in pieces besides the stone wall behind the cottage. Detective King finally had his killer, but Fish couldn't stop confessing. He described other murders that he had committed between 1910 and 1934. Much of what he told the police turned out to be false or exaggerated, but he still provided enough details to convince the investigators that he had killed before. Some have suggested that he may have killed dozens of people. The detectives were also chilled to discover that Fish had been arrested in the New York area 6 times since the disappearance of Grace Budd, on charges that ranged from petty larceny to vagrancy to sending obscene letters through the post office. 3 of the arrests occurred in a 3-month period after Grace had been kidnapped, but each time the charges for him were dismissed. As for the other arrests, he walked free each time with either a short period of incarceration or a small fine. No one ever guessed that the old man was actually a depraved killer. One of the few people not surprised at the arrest of Fish was his own son, Albert Fish Jr. He said, "That old skunk, I always knew he would get caught for something like this." He went on to tell of his father's love for raw meat and how he had come home one day to find his father stripped naked and beating himself with a heavy board that was studded with sharp nails. He said he threw the old man out of his house shortly after and concluded his interview in disgust. "I've never wanted anything to do with him, and I won't lift a hand to help him." Fish was examined by teams of doctors, and he relished in the notoriety. He described his fetishes and his perversions to the fascinated psychiatrist, telling of inserting needles into his scrotum. Later, X-rays revealed 29 rusty needles were in his body. He also said that he would insert wool that was doused with lighter fluid into his anus before setting it on fire. One psychiatrist, in particular, Dr. Friedrich Wertham, got remarkably close to Fish before and after his trial. He later wrote that Fish looked like a meek and innocuous little old man, gentle and benevolent, friendly and polite. If you wanted someone to entrust your children to, he would be the one that you would choose. However, he then went on to describe Fish as the most complex example of a polymorphous pervert he had ever known. Someone who had practiced every perversion and deviation known to man, from sodomy to sadism to eating excrement to self-mutilation. He even confessed to Wertham that he had carried Grace's ears and nose back to New York with him, wrapped in newspaper. He placed the bundle on his lap as he traveled by train and quivered with the excitement as he thought about what was inside. Like the other examining physicians, Wertham judged Fish to be insane. He said that Fish was a sadist of incredible cruelty. And as a self-employed painter, Fish had sulked around basements and cellars for 50 years and preyed on scores of innocent children. He could not begin to guess how many victims the man had claimed, but I believe, to the best of my knowledge, that he has raped 100 children, at least. He came to Sing Sing Prison in 1935, carrying a Bible and handcuffed to another murderer named Stone, whose forefathers had also fought in the American Revolution. Dozens of appeals to save Fish were rejected, and he was scheduled to die on January 16, 1936. As his appointment with the electric chair grew closer, Fish told reporters that he was looking forward to his execution. He said, "It'll be the only thrill I haven't tried." And on January 16th, Fish ate his last meal, which was a steak, and without aid, entered the death room and walked briskly to the electric chair. He climbed into the seat and readily helped the guards fix the electrodes to his legs. The reporters and witnesses who were present were aghast at his behavior. He could barely manage to contain his joy at going to a violent death. Legend has it that death didn't come quickly for Mr. Fish. When the switch was pulled, according to the story, the first massive jolt of over 3,000 volts failed to kill him. Blue smoke appeared around him, but that was all, and it has been surmised that the needles that he had put into his body actually created a short circuit. Another prolonged and massive charge had to be sent through his body in order to execute him, or that's how the story goes. In truth, Fish died just like anyone else. When the current raced through him, his body surged and his fist clenched. Moments later, the doctor on duty pronounced Fish, the oldest man ever executed at Sing Sing, was dead.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsafe the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsafe the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Ugh, truly terrifying tale. You know, people like this, I mean, it's just so scary that there's people actually out there that can do something like this and that they could be out there right now that you don't even know about.
Well, and that's what
you could be living next to them.
The thing that bothers me, look, we talk about monsters and creepy stuff on this thing and cover a lot of it, but it still seems a human being is the scariest monster of all.
I think so.
Of what we're so capable of. I mean, such great artwork and love and music, and then also capable of this.
But what they say that's also is like the guy looked like your typical grandpa.
Yeah.
That's why he was picked up and released so many times. It's like nobody thought that he was this vicious murderer.
Yeah.
Who was eating children. I mean, literally eating children.
Well, there was one thing, we even laughed about it, like I told you, when he was arrested in 1930 for sending, this is what it said, for sending an obscene letter to a woman who had answered an advertisement for a maid.
Right.
And we laughed because it's like, even in the 1930s, that's a way of like sending dirty text messages and stuff. You know?
Right. That's
like,
exactly what it was. Hey, it's a real primitive form of that.
Dirty old creeper. Yeah. It's, man, I don't know. It's one of those deals. I would like to say, I guess, I don't know what a better word to even use besides fun to discuss this. It's very interesting to discuss these things because it's something that I think is what we enjoy. UFOs, ancient history, you know, you kind of use that to almost forget about what's going on in society with the people that you share the bus with, you share a restaurant with and all that. It's also one of those things that you kind of use it as a filter. You don't want to think about this, but it's good. It's good to make sure you familiarize yourself with the fact that these people are out there.
And he was spanking and beating these kids for days, trying to tenderize their meat.
Yes.
I mean, just how do you go from one day being a little bit crazy to decide, look, like I want to start eating people? I mean, I just want to, you know, not like a cannibal who's starving and having to eat, but like you're just like, you make that choice one day. You know what? I'm looking at that woman walking over there and she's got a good build, good physical. It looks like she's in good shape. I want to like to eat that, like literally cook it and eat it.
Right. Well, just also too, what about the fact of how he would basically not really mutilate, but the things he would do to himself.
Oh, yeah. They found like 20 different needles in his body when they x-rayed it.
Yeah. Down there in his, around his
genitals and stuff.
Yeah. In his pelvic region.
Oh, man.
It's disturbing. And it's always those ones like we talk about that you never, it's just like, you just never see him. You're like, hey, he just seemed like a normal dude to me.
How many of those guys are out there right now?
Almost every time. Of course, then you get like Richard Ramirez and stuff where you just, the minute you see those guys, you're like, yep, you know, something's wrong with that guy. You right. know, it's not like they got like three eyes, which would make it even easier. Before we get out of here, Brad, get off this. There's something else that went crazy here. I kept looking into more and more of the clown motel stuff I told you about, right?
Yeah.
Well, apparently there is a tale that it's haunted. That not only is it what people consider the creepiest, scariest hotel on the planet, but it's also haunted. And in fact, there's a tale that comes from Reddit. Now, who knows if this is real or not, okay? Like we said, it's from Reddit. We have no idea. But I'm going to read you what it says. Now, mind you, I'm going to have to change a little bit of it because it's a bit graphic of what this dude wrote. But he writes this. He says, at one point early in the evening, I guess this is supposed to be around Christmas, but he said, at one point early in the evening, we're hearing strange sounds and what appeared to be someone screaming, followed by a lot of popping and crunching noises. While in the bathroom, my buddy decided to have a peek outside the bathroom window. My buddy lets out a yell and busts out into the room, and I'm like, what? He doesn't say anything, but goes right to his back, gets his 357 out, and I'm thinking, what the hell is going on? He said, so I dig into my bag, and I get out a SIG 232. He says, we need to get the heck out of here right now. So we grabbed our stuff, and basically he said, and he said, I knew he was serious and made me serious about it. And all. We left a few clothes behind. He said, we grabbed our stuff, looked out the peep sight to make sure it was clear to the car. He said, I threw my gun in the pocket. He put his in his waistband, and we took off to the car and got out of there. He said, on the ride away, I asked what he saw in the bathroom. He told me when he looked out the window that there was this creepy clown facing away from the window, pants at his ankles, making a weird motion. He told me the clown slowly turned 90 degrees to look at him, said he looked down and the clown was having sex with a full-sized dinner ham. And looked
what?
Up. Yeah, he's having sex with a dinner ham. And he said he looks and sees that, and the clown makes eye contact with him with this menacing grin and just starts waving at him while he's doing it.
This is a ghost clown.
Well, they're just talking about, he doesn't say ghost, but they talk about it being haunted. But this is something that actually happened in there. Now, that almost sounds a little too strange to be true, right?
Yeah, I think the owner of the clown motel made that up on Reddit to attack, you know, new clients.
Well, but that, who would that attack? I'm not going there. I don't know who would attract.
Not.
Unless you're a ham salesman, but you know, I don't know. But anyway, so folks, let me retract what I said before the segment. You may not want to go to the clown motel after all.
No, I would not.
But it's fascinating that this thing is even out there. It really, really is. And in fact, I think Greg Newkirk went there like a year or so ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think he's actually been there and did some stuff with it to take some video of it or something. I don't know. I remember seeing something online about that. So I'd have to try to get in touch with him and see what he says about the clown motel.
That's crazy. Well, let's give a few plugs before we leave. Don't forget, folks, if you're listening to this on iTunes or on YouTube or somewhere else like that, don't forget we offer an additional show every Thursday called Expanded Perspectives Elite. Signing up is easy. Go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Click on there and you'll have access to our entire back catalog as well as a new episode every Thursday. I think there's about 99 episodes on there right now. Mm. And so you can go back and listen to all that. If you'd like to help out the show, please write a review for us on iTunes. If you'd like to share a story with the show, you can email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call in and leave us your story, 817-945-3828. Cam, I know it's a holiday. I'm not going to take up too much more of your time. Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we get out of here?
Well, I've got some friends of ours. One of them is a custom woodworker, and his wife is maybe soon to be wife, girlfriend, lady friend, whatever. She is a professional photographer. We actually helped them a while back get their podcast up and going, and I'm trying to get them to keep it going. I think they've taken some time off, but I tell you what, it was an interesting thing, and I want to get you folks to go listen if you have so an inkling to listen to it. It's called Pair of Spades Podcast. Pair of Spades. What it is they're both divorced, and the woman, Heather, she comes from like a side of being the woman that left her husband and took the kids and all that stuff. And Shad, you know, we went to school together. He comes from having his wife leave him and take the kids, and he gets, you know, some custody. But they basically they're sharing both their insight on what it's like to go through such a thing. So if you're having any issues or just want to support some really great people, Shad and Heather do this podcast. And I'll tell you what, coming from a broken home as growing up, it was really neat to listen to, because you're like, man, I never thought about that. So you kind of get, so any of those folks, if you're single or you've been through it or whatnot, and you just think, much like the stories that we talk about, we get a lot of people, like we always say, that said, man, I can't believe you discussed that. I thought I was the only one. If you have that feeling about other things outside of the strangeness and stuff that we cover, check out Pair of Spades Podcast. You'll enjoy it. I like, they're just fun and they're off the cuff, and they record it sitting there in their house, and it was just a lot of fun, and they're good folks. And like I said, I think November was the last one that they released. I talked to Shad like a few days ago, and he's like, man, they got hammered with work and they just haven't got around to it. And I said, dude, you got to start doing it. They were good at it. I like what they did. So if you think it might interest you, check that stuff out, you know. And like we said, if you like history, always check out Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Can't go wrong with Dan.
Right. Well, everybody out there, be safe. Take care of each other. Give someone a hug. And for God's sake, stay out of trouble. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale. For Pretty Lights, New Page Books, Inner Tradition Books, Llewellyn Books, and Ancient American Magazine, we'll talk to you next week, folks.
Peace.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.